Suffering a sharp decline in its parliamentary seats, Iraq's Fatah Alliance now says it will appeal against the election results. Another achievement for Iran's armed forces, the country successfully test launches several homemade air defense systems during the second day of military exercises. And China says there is no need to worry about its military drills near Taiwan, which are only actions to ward off foreign threats and keep the region safe. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. We begin in Iraq with the showdown among influential political groups over the preliminary results of parliamentary elections. Fatah Alliance now says it will do all it can to protect the ballots. Take a listen to what the movement's spokesman had to say about the early outcome of the vote.
We will not withdraw, we will not stand back. We'll continue to defend your voices. This is for all our people, all our brothers and sisters who have run for the elections, the candidates, all those candidates that gave in objections and complaints from this election, first of all, in order to fight or defend their voices and votes of our supporters, but also the votes of all the Iraqis.
Assadi also complained about lack of transparency in the announcement of the results. Leader of the Fatah Alliance, Hadi Al-Ahmadi, earlier said he will in no way accept the results that are, in his words, fabricated. But the leader of the Sadr movement has advised against such objections, saying pressuring the election commission could trigger acts of terrorism in Iraq. Muqtada al-Sadr has called on everyone to be patient and make their objections heard through legal means. Based on initial results, Fatah has only won about a dozen seats, down from 48 before, but Sadr's bloc has expanded its grip with more than 70 seats. Our correspondent in Baghdad, Wissam Bahrani, tells us about concerns the differences over the vote results could lead to violence across Iraq.
As these changes occur and revised in the coming days, we're seeing an increase in security presence across the country, but especially in the capital, Baghdad. And there are fears, you know, that as these disputes occur, that there could be some form of violence, which is the last thing Iraq wants to see. And all the parties are very aware and very conscious that this is a plot. That if was designed pre-planned by enemy forces of Iraq to try and get these Shia blocs to fight among themselves.
The Iranian army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps are holding a joint air defense drill for a second day. The exercises are being staged in Semnan, a central province of Iran. Several domestically made air defense systems have been successfully tested. The drills also feature homemade missiles, radars, reconnaissance, and electronic warfare, as well as communication systems. Troops are conducting tactical and defense operations using detection and combat systems against mock enemy aircraft. Iran says the drills aim to boost domestic air defense capability. Iran has delivered humanitarian aid to the northern Afghan city of Kunduz several days after it was targeted by a deadly bomb attack. The humanitarian assistance was sent to Afghanistan by a plane. It included foods, medicines, and medical equipment. A medical team accompanied the convoy, too. Iran has already condemned the Friday bomb blast and expressed sympathy with the families of the victims. The attack targeted a Shia mosque as worshippers were offering Friday prayers. The Daesh terror group claimed the attack that killed dozens and injured many more. The spokesman for the Yemeni army has reported the liberation of another 600 square kilometers from Saudi-backed forces in Ma'arib province. Yahya Sarai said the Yemeni armed forces are now inching closer to the provincial capital. He said 1,300 enemy forces were killed and 11 spy drones were stuck down in the operation. Sarai vowed that the Yemeni army will continue operations to fully liberate areas under enemy control in the central province. Sarai added, Yemeni people remain steadfast in resisting aggression against, despite sanctions and blockade. Meanwhile, Yemeni forces have intensified their military operations to liberate the strategic Ma'arib province from all the foreign powers, including the Saudi-backed forces. International lawyer Barry Grossman joins us now from Bali to offer us more on that story. Mr. Grossman, welcome to the program. Let's talk about the advances that are being made by the Yemeni army. How significant are these advances, and what do they mean in the bigger picture in the war on Yemen?
Well, certainly the advances provide encouragement to the people of Yemen and indicate what everybody's known for a very long time, which is that no matter what the allies of Saudi Arabia do to support its belligerent war on Yemen, there is no military solution to this war. They've long recognized that there can only really be a diplomatic solution, but they're not particularly interested in seeking one out. For its part, Iran has been encouraging Saudi Arabia to, as a gesture of good faith, to reopen its embassies in Saudi Arabia in order to establish the channels needed to try and resolve this impasse, since for their part, the Saudis some kind of a pro-Iran. But the simple fact of the matter is that there is no military solution here. It's high time the Saudis accepted what they've long realized and stopped this belligerent war, which from the outset was supported by the United Nations and, of course, the United States, the United Kingdom, to some extent, the European Union, Israel, and others, not the least of which, of course, is Emirates. Sadly, in recent weeks, the mandate that had existed from the UN for a war crimes investigation come tribunal was voted to an end after a great deal of lobbying by the Saudis. So they're breathing a sigh of relief, and that can only serve as further encouragement for the Saudis to continue this belligerent war. But the one thing that emerges very clear from this, and that is that the Saudis cannot, they're incapable of winning this war, which started, of course, as a result of their refusal to accept that the former president Hadi, who had resigned, very much like his counterpart in Ukraine, resigned and ran off to Russia with the Atlantic world powers accepting that as a final act of resignation. President Hadi resigned, having overstayed his electoral mandate by a full year longer than he was supposed to without calling an election. And it's now for the people of Yemen to decide how they're going to rule themselves, since we're no longer living in the colonial era. Yemen is Yemen, Saudi Arabia is Saudi Arabia, and the sooner that the House of Saud accepts that, the sooner we can see some progress towards a resolution. In the meantime, it's the civilians, the men, women, and children who've been through a great hardship already who continue to suffer, because it's the civilians of Yemen who are primarily targeted by this belligerent war that's been waged by Saudi Arabia, the United Nations, the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, Emirates, and others.
Mr. Grossman, a quick question before we leave you. Would you say that the international community has failed the people of Yemen?
Absolutely. Not only have they failed the people of Yemen, the leadership in the Atlantic, in the international community, in the Atlantic world, is they're guilty of war crimes. But what we see once again is that the Atlantic world does not abide by the same international system which it tries to use as a weapon in order to coerce other nations which don't fully submit to U.S. hegemony into doing what they're expected to do. But there can be no doubt about it. The Yemeni people have been failed by the international community, and the political leadership of that community is guilty of war crimes.
All right, thanks a lot. International lawyer Barry Grossman joining us from Bali. We're going to go back to a previous story where the Iranian army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps are holding a joint air defense drill for a second day, which is being staged in the in Semnan, a central province in Iran. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali is joining us now from Semnan to offer us some more insight and some more details about these drills. Yusuf?
Well, Daria, as you also mentioned, this is a drill that is held jointly by the Iranian Army's Air Defense Units and the Iranian IRGC Force, Air Force Division. Of course, this drill is a routine drill which involves different units of the Iranian Army and the IRGC to jointly try to defend the Iranian skies against possible threats. This time around, of course, the drill was held in the province of Semnan. It used to be held in other places as well, such as Isfahan. This time, it was held over a 500,000 square kilometer area. This is half the area of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the drill is very significant, and it sends the message of peace and stability and security to the region. As I was talking to the Iranian military commanders, they told me that it seeks to boost the Iranian deterrence against possible threat. And it is also a chance for the Iranian armed forces to keep and maintain synergy and coordination between different units of the Iranian armed forces. Let me talk to Brigadier General Rahimzadeh, who is the commander of the drills. خیلی خوش آمدید امیر. بفرمایید که در فاز دوم
in the second phase of the drills, what are the measures you're going to take up? And so far, what have you done so far? And what is the message of the drills? In the name of God, we are getting closer to the closing stages, the final stages of the drills. All the objectives set in the course of designing the drills have been realized due to the efforts made within an integrated network. We have realized all the set objectives, all the drones and the cruise missiles that wanted to enter the area. They were targeted by our missiles. In general, a complicated environment was designed, and based on our perception and understanding of the threats, we created a similar environment, and all the systems, including missiles, some radar systems, and the electronic warfare systems, data collection systems, they all managed to fulfill their duties and missions with 100% success. How about the message of the drills for Iranians and the neighboring states? The message of the drills for our nation and our friendly and neighboring states is a message of peace, security, and friendship. We want to maintain the security of our skies, but the message for the enemies is that our armed forces are strong and have received technical training, and our armed forces enjoy homegrown systems, and we are fully prepared to defend our skies, and we will definitely give a crushing and decisive response to the enemies. Thank you very much.
We'll wrap up today. This is the last phase of the drill, and let me tell you something. The drill tries to, of course, simulate real-life war scenarios where Iran's major facilities and vital facilities are the target and must be protected using Iranian homegrown defense systems like the one that you see behind me, which is dubbed 15th of Khordad missile system. It is a low-altitude and a short-range missile system that can target any cruise missile, inbound cruise missile, that is targeting Iranian major facilities such as Iran's nuclear sites. So this is the scenario that it has been planned for this two-day drill. And Iran has used indigenously built weapons and missile systems to conduct this drill. And this is a message that Iran can survive and Iran can defend its borders and its soil using its own homegrown military equipment, given the fact that the country has been under four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes that targeted the Iranian defense sector and prompted the country to try to build up its own defense arsenal. And Now, Iran boasts its self-sufficiency in the defense sector and has been holding and carrying out and conducting different drills every year, routine drills, to try to show its force, show its might, and tell the world, and especially the United States, that it can survive and it can defend its own skies using its own homegrown military equipment. Bardia.
All right. Thanks a lot, Yousef Jalali, joining us from the central province of Semnan. Moving on, Beijing is seeking to ease concerns about its military exercises near Taiwan. It says the drills are meant to counter foreign interference and deal with forces seeking to separate the island from mainland China.
The PLA's military drills are necessary, aiming to safeguard national sovereignty and territorial integrity, targeted at secessionist activities aiming at Taiwan independence and interference of external forces, with the purpose of fundamentally safeguarding the overall interests of the Chinese nation and the vital interests of compatriots on both sides of the straits.
China's Office for Taiwan Affairs said the purpose of the drills is to promote peace and stability. The current tensions, it added, stem from the island's collusion with foreign forces and separatist activities. Recently, China has flown a record number of military jets over Taiwan's airspace after Britain sent a warship through the Taiwan Strait. Also, Taipei's growing military reliance on Washington has upset Beijing. Still, Chinese and Taiwanese presidents offered a more conciliatory tone in their weekend speeches. China claims sovereignty over Taiwan. The International Monetary Fund says the coronavirus pandemic and inequitable vaccine distributions are worsening the economic divide and darkening prospects for developing nations. The IMF chief economist also warned that a prolonged pandemic downturn could reduce global GDP by a cumulative $5.3 trillion over the next 5 years. The IMF has predicted 5.9% growth output this year, which is lower than its July projection. It said advanced economies could regain their pre-pandemic trend next year and exceeded by 0.9% in 2024. However, in developing economies, including China, the output is expected to remain 5.5% below the pre-pandemic forecast. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Culture, Politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. A report by U.S. national security and intelligence experts has warned that climate change could become a catastrophic security threat on both national and global levels. We're prepared for you an article written by Ellie Silverman. The piece is titled Climate Protesters Ask Biden to Follow Through on His Campaign Promises. climate protesters have gathered at the White House in Washington, D.C., where they warned U.S. President Joe Biden to take their demands seriously and declare a national emergency and end projects involving fossil fuels. According to the Fox News Channel, the Build Back Fossil Free Coalition took to the streets in Washington, D.C. on Monday, 11th of October, which is part of the five-day-long effort aimed at spurring action by the Biden administration against climate change. Zekinik Mopin, who is the director of coalition core member, the Sovereign Inupiat for the Living Arctic, told Fox News Channel in an email statement on Monday, 11th of October, that they arranged the demonstration because they believe that President Biden needs to fulfill his campaign promises. Zekinik Mopin wrote, "People are dying right now from the pollutants, the toxins, the climate catastrophes that are happening, and we have to stop the harm. Biden's election was riding on climate change. His entire election hinged on turning out people of color and indigenous peoples." Zekinik Mopin continued by saying, "But when it really comes to what matters, our lives are still being sacrificed for oil and gas. That is why we're here today," Biden censured over empty words. The Indigenous Environment Network, or IEN, which is a broad alliance of tribes, indigenous rights groups, labor organizations, and others, said in a statement on Monday that President Biden has consistently fallen short of protecting the water that sustains all life on Mother Earth and continuously failed to honor our treaties. The alliance noted that President Biden has so far not moved to block Enbridge's Line 3 placement project in Minnesota, where Native Americans have led several demonstrations. The statement added, "If President Biden was committed to honoring the treaties and strengthening sovereignty, he would implement a policy of free prior and informed consent by executive authority and act swiftly to mitigate the climate chaos that has engulfed our communities by ending the anti-indigenous U.S. legacy of fossil fuel extractivism." The alliance said, "We have had enough of your empty words. Our communities need clean water, land returned, divestment from the fossil fuel industry, and healing from residential school traumas." President Biden has pledged to transition the U.S. economy towards clean energy and reduce emissions from coal, natural gas, and oil. Biden brought the U.S. back into the Paris Climate Accord in January after former President Donald Trump pulled the country out of the treaty. Biden has asked Congress to approve a $36 billion budget for fighting global warming in 2022. The lion's share of the budget will be allocated to clean energy initiatives, innovations, and research, while a lesser share will go to the building infrastructures for storage and transmission of clean energy, as well as retrofitting homes and federal buildings. Independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and Democratic representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Earl Blumenauer in February introduced legislation that required President Biden to declare a national emergency on climate change. Former President Donald Trump had labeled climate change a hoax, defying widening international support for the Paris Climate Accord to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Donald Trump argued that the concept of global warming had been created by and for the Chinese in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive. In June of 2017, Donald Trump announced that he was pulling out of the 2015 Global Paris Climate Accord to fight climate change, characterizing his decision as a reassertion of American sovereignty. The move drew a rebuke from Democrats at home and world leaders who had pressured Donald Trump not to abandon the 197-nation accord. He argued that remaining in the Paris climate deal would hurt America's economy. A report by U.S. national security and intelligence experts warned that climate change could become a catastrophic security threat on both national and global levels. Experts wrote in a report released by the National Security, Military and Intelligence Panel of the Center for Climate and Security, as quoted by The Hill in February of 2020, global warming will pose catastrophic and likely irreversible global security risks over the course of the 21st century. The report warned that all regions across the globe face serious implications, adding that global warming could bring catastrophic security impacts across the globe. The United States is the world's second largest emitter of greenhouse gases. Meanwhile, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Senator Chuck Schumer warned that extreme weather witnessed in the United States showed that global warming is upon us right now. Hurricane Ida killed at least 22 people in New York and New Jersey area earlier this month. Senator Chuck Schumer said recently at a press conference with New York Governor Kathy Hochul and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, he said, "Woe is us if we don't recognize these changes are due to climate change. Woe is us if we don't do something about it quickly." Senator Chuck Schumer promised to secure as much federal disaster aid as was needed to be able to respond effectively to the dire situation caused by the extreme weather conditions. Promising to ensure no stone is left unturned, he said, "We will fight and make New York declared a disaster area, and that will mean money for homeowners, for business owners, and city and local governments."
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesley. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has vowed to double, if not quadruple, the population of the occupied Golan Heights, and that, as he claims, in response to Iran planning to build an army on the border in that area. Tel Aviv regime occupied the Syrian Heights in the course of a war in 1967. No country has recognized Israeli sovereignty to the Golan except the United States. Now let's go to Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus, and let's hear the Syrian side of the story and how they react to this. Mohammed, over to you.
Yes, the Syrian people always reject the Israeli occupation in the occupied Syrian Golan. All of the villages there, the residents, they continuously express that clearly in rallies and protests. The recent was in Mas'ad, the village, just a couple of days ago, in the occupied Syrian Golan, in which residents there rallied, rejecting the implementation of any Israeli settlement plan on their territories, on their lands, and they said that they will block the Israeli occupation authorities from taking control over their land. On the other hand, the Syrian Foreign Ministry issued yesterday an official statement condemning strongly the statements of the Israeli Prime Minister on increasing the number of Israeli settlers in the occupied Syrian Golan. The An official source at the foreign ministry actually here in Damascus said that such statements confirm once again the expansionist and aggressive nature of the Zionist entity, and also it shows its clear violation of international resolutions, namely the United Nations Security Council resolutions, on the legal status quo of the Golan, which is an occupied territory. Also, the foreign ministry said that such statements and aggressive policies will not change the truth and the fact that this that the Syrian Golan was and will remain a Syrian land and will be restored by Syria no matter how much time it takes. Finally, it's very important to say that the Syrian government officials always say in their statements with regards to the occupied Golan that Syria reserves the right to carry out any means possible in order to restore back the occupied Syrian Golan. We know that Syria tried diplomacy and negotiations, but the Israeli side always rejected to give it back.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Tamar Majali, our correspondent in Damascus, Syria. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Nezafi, and today we'll be discussing Israeli land grab. Let me introduce our guests in this edition. From the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, we'll be joined by Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. Also, from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, we'll have Ken Stone out of Hamilton, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, now let me start as first a hello and welcome to our guests. Now let me put this question to Mick. Mick, as you know, Israel occupied the Golan Heights, but the move has not been recognized by the international community. It's only the U.S. recognized. So one basic question, what's the strategic significance of the Golan Heights for the Tel Aviv regime?
For the Tel Aviv regime, it's the same as the whole Palestine, its resources, and the colonization of the Golan by the Tel Aviv regime is aimed at several things. One, a third of Israel's water, current area that Israel controls, one third of the total amount of water comes from the Golan, and Netanyahu and his fellows, that's why they insisted Israel was going to hold on to the Golan forever. Now, not a single country apart from Trump's USA and Biden going along with it recognizes this annexation. But it's strategic, it's for resources, it's a place where Israel tries to build, you know, more illegal settlements. So it's strategy, population dissemination across that area. And it's very, very similar to Palestine. When the land was occupied in 67, Israel drove out, very similar to Palestine, about 90% of the Arab population. About 130,000 people were kicked out, expelled immediately. Mm. And Israel thought that it could integrate and do a deal with the remaining Arabs, who were mainly Druze, and that has proven not to be the case. That Druze population are adamant that they're Syrian. They have resisted. What's different from Palestine is Israel's constantly trying to deny Palestinians any citizenship, certainly including Israel. Mm-hmm. But in the Golan Heights, they have been trying to force Israeli citizenship on the Arab population. And that has been fiercely resisted since 1967 until the present day. Israel's attempts, using all sorts of bureaucratic measures, physical pressure as well. That has been resisted by the Syrian Arab Druze population.
Naftali Bennett says that in 6 weeks' time, Tel Aviv will approve a plan for the Golan Heights that will include the creation of settlement. So what gives this regime the audacity to make such an open announcement in broad daylight?
They can make such an audacious proposal because they have the backing of many of the, first of all, the U.S. empire and most of its allies in the West, in NATO and other countries. The proposal itself is flagrantly illegal because it flies in the face of the 1949 Geneva Agreement on the treatment of peoples under occupation, to which my country, Canada, was a high consenting party. And rather than enforcing the rules of the Geneva Convention of 1949, which say that you cannot, that the occupier may not change the demographic balance of the populations under occupation, Canada instead is one of the countries that enables this colonization, enables the creation of these settlements by allowing organizations in Canada, such as the Jewish National Fund of Canada, which raises money with its charitable status granted by the Canadian government to give tax-free tax-free donations from Canadians to the State of Israel to build these Jewish-only settlements. So what the practical result is that by giving these tax-free donations to the State of Israel, all Canadians are forced to subsidize these donations, which are being used illegally to colonize the Golan Heights, just as they are in the West Bank, and they are used to try and alter the demographic balance of that region, which is flagrantly illegal.
Right. Now, Mick, in regard to Golan Heights, Bennett is saying they're doing this because of Iran, and they'll do whatever necessary to end Iran's presence in Syria. Bennett says Iran has no business there. Now, it's Israel that has been launching, you know, hundreds of airstrikes against Syrian positions since 2011, not Iran. So who's making an adventure, Iran or Israel?
Well, look at the long-term record. Look at the words of Israeli leaders, among whom the most iconic is Ben-Gurion. Mm. And he was absolutely clear that the Zionist project in Palestine, even if it remains in Palestine, need weakened and devastated Arab neighbors. I mean, today there are maybe 6 million Zionist Jews, a million or so non-Zionist Jews in Palestine, controlling that area, surrounded by hundreds of millions of Arabs. Now, that situation cannot endure for very long, even with Israel's military edge, unless its neighbors are destroyed or its neighbors are greatly weakened. And we see what's happened in Syria as an example. So it's part of Israeli policy to ensure its own so-called security by denying basic conditions of life to the citizens of neighboring countries. And, you know, we're in an era of a second wave of colonialism. The rules that our fellow guest alludes to, which were passed after World War II, by and large, international law, the prohibition of the seizure and obtaining land by conquest, that was never intended for colonial peoples. And we now see a kind of Sykes-Picot Mark II, where when Britain and France divided up the Middle East and they drew the lines dividing neighbors from neighbors and setting up countries after the First World War, we now see Donald Trump giving the Golan to the Israeli government. More recently, we saw the Americans giving the Western Sahara to Morocco in return for recognition of Zionist claims in Palestine. So,
right,
once again, the fate of local people is being decided in Washington and elsewhere. So, yeah, the Zionist project needs virtually permanent war, and that has been the record since 1948.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ken, the Israeli Prime Minister says, as I just said, Iran has nothing to do in Syria, and this is while Iran is in Syria under request of the Syrian government. What's Bennett talking about?
The Israeli Prime Minister is trying to whip up hatred and fear of Iran in his own country, so it's partly for domestic use, and it's a narrative that plays in well with the U.S. Media and government narrative as well. Iran is an independent country with its own agenda for politics and economics, and it's not been compliant with the wishes of the United States for the last 40 years since the Islamic Revolution. And the U.S. has gone, the U.S. and Israel have both gone out of their way to try and bring down. They've been trying for regime change in Iran for 40 years, and any of the countries that are allied to it, such as Syria. But Iran has every right to be in Syria, because they are invited into Syria by the Syrian government to resist the attempt by the United States and its allies, including Israel, to overthrow the Syrian government. And to add, as my colleague Mick Napier has alluded to, it's a plan to destabilize and break up the Arab countries of the region, the better to be able to control them, just as they did with Libya and Iraq, and they tried in Yemen as well. They're trying in Yemen as well. But the fact is that this demonstration that we're talking about today is a great sign of the demonstration of the people in the Golan Heights resisting the Israeli settlements, because it's showing the increasing strength of the resistance across the region to Israeli occupation and to the U.S. empire meddling in the affairs of the Middle East. So I say kudos to the demonstrators, and I say kudos to Press TV for giving voice to them. Press TV gives the voice to the voiceless, and this is a good example of the amplification of the grassroots demand in the countries of the Middle East that Israel get out, stop its occupation, and the U.S. empire withdraw from the region.
Okay, speaking of the U.S., Mick, there's only one country on the planet recognizing Israel's capture of Syria's Golan Heights. That's the United States. And former President Trump recognized Israel's sovereignty over this strategic plateau in 2019. There was also a new town called Trump Heights that was inaugurated on the Golan to honor his move. Your take on that?
Yes, I mean, it's very revealing. The only place in the world where Trump was viewed very positively was the state of Israel, and very prominent among that were the few settlers in the Golan. Look, Israel enjoys the staunch support, not just of the USA, but a little bit more subtly, not very subtly, by the EU and, of course, by the British government as well. And the reason's very simple. The resistance we see in the Golan by the Syrian Arab Druze, indigenous people of the Golan, is a sign that the Zionist project runs into problems. America does not trust the Saudi regime, or the Emiratis, or the even the Egyptians or the Moroccans, these monarchies, to survive well into the 21st century. They do trust Israel. Israel being a settler colonial project, it's not a case of the government allying with America against the wishes of the population, which is the case in Arab countries. It's a case of the mass of the Jewish population there, the Zionist population, which is privileged by that link and given domination over the Palestinians. They actually support the link with Washington. Washington knows that. Everybody knows that. Therefore, they allow Israel to do pretty much what it wants. There are some exceptions when they pull on the chain, but generally speaking, that's why Israel's allowed to seize a part of the Golan. Now, it's absolutely criminal, and it's also criminal that the native people of the Golan are now, like the Palestinians, in fact, the numbers are almost the same. that the Golan Arabs are restricted to about 7% of the area, which they used to be the majority of people in, just as Palestinians are now reduced to living in about 6% of 1948 Israel. So it's colonization, it's dispossession, it's trying to put surplus populations or difficult populations, non-Jewish populations, into increasingly small ghettos. America doesn't hate the people of the Golan. It doesn't even hate the Palestinians. It gives Israel its green light because Israel is a huge strategic asset. As Hassan Nasrallah said, when you're fighting Israel, you're actually fighting America, because America ultimately, despite what many people think, America ultimately calls the tune for Israel. Israel's got some autonomy, but when it goes too far, America puts it in its place. But it means Israel's allowed to do pretty much what it wants as long as it remains loyal to Uncle Sam.
Okay. Speaking of Uncle Sam, the rumors that in June the Biden administration was planning to reverse the recognition, which infuriated the Israelis. Then we had a U.S. State Department spokesperson coming out and saying that a U.S. policy regarding the Golan has not changed. And Washington continues to recognize the Northern Plateau as Israeli territory. So the question is, what is it that makes the U.S. stick to its unwavering support for Israel, no matter who's at the helm of the White House?
Well, I think my colleague Nick Napier alluded to that just now when he said that Israel is a beachhead, is a power projection point for the U.S. empire in the Middle East. And because of that, the U.S. gives it a blank check. It gives it money. It gives it arms. It gives it political support and diplomatic support, because it's like a military base for the U.S. in the Middle East. And no matter who is in charge in Israel, the policy towards the Palestinians and the policy of the aggrandizement of the Zionist colonial project is always the same. And whoever is in the White House, the policy doesn't change either. The policy remains the same, and that is that the U.S. is seeking hegemony in the Middle East. It's seeking hegemony, domination over the entire world. And Israel is one of the pillars of that hegemony in the Middle East. It has other countries it relies on, such as the Arab monarchies, but Israel is the most secure and dependable ally of the U.S., and so it gets favored child status from the U.S., and all of the NATO allies and all of the EU fall in right behind. The EU gives Israel a special status, almost the status of a member state of the EU, such that Israel gets to have all the benefits of the economic relationship with the EU. So it's a neo-colonial project. Israel represents the boots on the ground for the European and North American colonial project in the Middle East.
Okay. Mick, what's the solution? I mean, what could Syria do, you know, to retake the occupied Golan Heights and restore its sovereignty there?
At the moment, little, because Israel has a huge military edge, which it is using to attack and bomb many parts of Syria. But in the long term, it will depend upon whether more countries join the USA or not in allocating the Golan, giving the Golan and its people to Israel. I think there's a protracted period where everything will rely upon the resistance of the native people of the Golan. What a record they have. You know, despite Israeli pressure, despite overwhelming Israeli power, they've once again demonstrated their determination not to become Israelis. This builds on mass identity card burning. Now, if you think about Israel, where the threat to remove an identity card has got life-changing consequences. In the Golan, we saw in the I forget the year, the early 80s, mass burning of identity cards by the Golan people. We saw very large strikes against attempts to impose Israeli nationality, Israeli citizenship. And that endures, and the current mobilization shows that the fires have not been extinguished, despite Israel's overwhelming power. This is so inspiring. And when resistance is strong enough, sometimes even America gets a little bit afraid. I think it's very instructive what happened last week. An Israeli court delivered over the Al-Aqsa Mosque to extremist fanatical Jews to use for their religious purposes. That was reversed.
Right.
And I think it was reversed because the Americans intervened to tell the Israelis that is just a step too far at the moment. That could be dangerous. They were afraid of the mass rebellion and resistance to that move. So I think the resistance in the Golan holds out the promise that the Zionist project in that area that it controls can be defeated.
Okay. Now, on that note, we come to the end of the show. Let me thank our guests from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. We had McNapier in Edinburgh and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, Ken Stone out of Hamilton, Ontario. I've been your host, Behrouz Medefinel. See you later.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن الله سبحانه وضع الثواب على طاعته والعقاب على معصيته زيادة لعباده عن نقمته وحياشة لهم إلى جنته.
Imam Ali said, Allah the Glorified has laid down reward for obedience to Him and punishment for committing sins against Him in order to save men from His chastisement and to drive them towards paradise. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find that it is unanimously agreed upon that Imam Ali, the blessed alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, was one of the most pious people in the history of Islam, and during his time he was the most pious man. And of course, why would it be any different, since Imam Ali was the living miracle, the disciple, and the best follower of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam. Now we see that despite this piety and this detachment from the world and this disassociation from the pleasures of the world, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, was wealthy, but despite his